It's time for Bigler's World. For the next hour, well, I'm Jim Bigler. See, I got all these kids' magazines over here, maybe a little science news explorers. Let's see, National Geographic Kids. I think I'll start with that. What else we got? Ranger Rick? I don't know. We'll see what happens. Let's start here with National Geographic Kids. It's Nat Geo time. What is this all about here? Weird but true sports. The shortest professional baseball player was 3 feet 7 inches tall, the height of an average 5-year-old. How about this one? You can compete in an underwater mountain bike race. That's in Wales in the United Kingdom. How about this one? Early lacrosse matches could have 2,000 players at once. I don't know how early that was. Prehistoric times? I don't know. Early golf balls were stuffed with bird feathers. And see, the highest known jump by a pig is 27.5 inches. That's the height of a St. Bernard. Somebody's measuring pigs jumping. Let's see, they got toe wrestling is a competitive sport. And that's the end of that whole article. Not really an article, necessarily. They got some more weird but true stuff here, though. A sailfish can leap through the air at 68 miles an hour. That's about the speed the car drives on the highway, if it's speeding just a little bit. The oldest koi fish lived to be 226 years old. That's crazy stuff. A salmon's sense of smell is thousands of times better than a dog's. And dogs have a really good sense of smell, apparently. Male seahorses give birth. I don't want to get into that. A shark can grow and lose up to 30,000 teeth in its lifetime. And let's see the last one they got here. Harmless microscopic shrimp may live in your drinking water. More weird but true animal stuff here. The smallest monkey is about as tall as a toothbrush. The skin of a golden poison dart frog contains enough toxins to kill up to 100 people. Yikes. The world's lightest mammal, the bumblebee bat, weighs about as much as 2 M&Ms. Alligators can live to be 80 years old, and they look 80 the entire time. A beefalo is part bison, part cow. And see, a camel doesn't sweat until its body temperature reaches 106 degrees Fahrenheit. I wished it didn't sweat at all. Some fish can walk on land. I think I knew that one. A flea can jump 100 times its body length. That's like you jumping to the top of a 34-story building. And let's see, what do they got here? Giant anteaters can eat more than 30,000 insects in a day and live to tell about it. And last one they got here, a snail would take about 220 hours to crawl 1 mile nonstop. Okay, next up, sticking with National Geographic Kids here on Bigler's World. Let's take a quiz. I think I could do this. It's online. Outdoor sports. Take this quiz to test your knowledge about sports played around the world. Okay, with 5 World Cup wins, which country has taken home this top soccer prize the most? South Africa, Germany, Austria, or Brazil? I'm going to click on Brazil. Let's see here. It tells me, did I get this right here? It says correct. I might have taken this before. I hope so. Professional soccer players run about how far during every game? Is it 500 yards? Is it 1,500 yards? Is it 3 miles? Is it 6 miles? Let's see. I'm going to say 6 miles. It says correct. I think I did take this because I got that one right. Now made of plastic and rubber, golf balls were once made of wood, clay, leather, or aluminum. I think the answer was leather. And I'm wrong. Golf balls were made out of wood. A bump or mound of hard snow on a ski slope is known as a spike, a mogul, an igloo, or a glacier. I'm pretty sure that's a mogul. It says right here, large mounds of snow you might find on ski slopes are called moguls. Totally cool. There are only 2 sports that have been played on the moon, golf and javelin throw, baseball and soccer, badminton and field hockey, and football and tennis. Well, we all know about the golfing thing here. Astronauts have played both golf and javelin throw after landing on the lunar surface. Let's see, held every year since 1875, which is the longest continually run sports event in the U.S.? Is it the Super Bowl, the U.S. Open, the Kentucky Derby, or the World Series? Got to be the Kentucky Derby. Yes, it's the longest continually run event in the U.S. And let's see, during the Wimbledon Championship in London, England, about how many tennis balls are used each year? Is it 5,000, 10,000, 43,000, or 54,000? I have no idea. I picked 43 and I'm wrong. It's 54,000 tennis balls are used each year during Wimbledon. And the last one here, soccer, rugby, cricket, boxing, and golf were all invented in which country? Is it Argentina, United Kingdom, United States, or China? I want to say United Kingdom, and it says correct. Soccer, they just repeat it. Soccer, rugby, golf, cricket, and boxing were invented in the United Kingdom. Okay, let us move along to science news. Science News Explorers. How much more can Olympic speed records fall, they ask. And then this title of this article. Humans are built to go faster than current world speed records, science suggests. And Aaron Garcias de Jesus writes about. Ready, set, go break a record. As elite athletes compete in the 2024 Summer Olympics there in Paris, they'll likely break at least a few world records, but no one has set a new record in more than a decade for two of the Olympics' fastest events, the 100-meter dash and the 50-meter freestyle swim. The plateau in top speed for these races raises a curious question. Just how much faster can humans move on land or through water? The 100-meter dash is a sprint to the finish. Usain Bolt of Jamaica set the current men's record in 2009. He ran it in just 9.58 seconds with a top speed of nearly 28 miles per hour. American sprinter Florence Griffith Joyner set the women's record for this race back in 1988. She ran it in 10.49 seconds. Human gait and muscle strength could let people go faster. Research suggests that people might be able to run as fast as 37 miles per hour. That is, in meters, 5.625 seconds. But sprinting speed largely depends on technique, says Ross Miller. He studies biomechanics at the University of Maryland in College Park. And he says, a sprint should be as hard as you can every step. Top speed depends on how little time our feet touch the ground while still applying the force necessary to propel us forward. Maybe no one yet has run at top human speed because no one has come along with the physical ability, Miller says. Or maybe the right person hasn't had access to the training. It's also possible, he notes, that the right person with the right training simply hasn't put it all together yet in the perfect race. In the past century, the fastest time for the 100-meter dash has shrunk in women by about 3 seconds, and in men, it has dropped by only 1 second. Swifter runs. Record times for the 100-meter dash have gone down about a second for men since record keeping began back in 1912. Women are running the race about 3 seconds faster since the first record was set in 1922. Florence Griffith Joyner is the current women's record holder, but that record is in doubt. It says here, winds over 2 meters per second disqualify new records. The wind gauge registered zero, but other races that day had logged winds. Still, the record stands. See, it's much harder for humans to go fast in water. The men's record for the 50-meter freestyle belongs to Cesar Cielo Filho. This Brazilian athlete swam 50 meters in 20.91 seconds back in 2009. That was about four times slower than Bolt's record-setting average running speed. In 2023, Swedish swimmer Sarah Sjormström, she earned the women's record for 50-meter freestyle by swimming the race in 23.61 seconds. Both top times are roughly 3 seconds faster than the first record set back in the 1970s. Swimming is slower than running, largely because water is far denser than air, explains Timothy Wee. He studies fluid dynamics at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. But also, Wee all have this bowling ball between our shoulders, we says. He's talking about the head. This thing creates a huge amount of drag. No one knows just how much faster swimmers can get, but swimming with the body parallel to the water's surface can help reduce drag. Super fast freestyle swimmers also raise their elbows as high as possible above the water. Then they plunge their arms close, straight down into the water to pull themselves forward. We says, if you get your technique right, you can get your stroke rate as high as possible. That combination is going to get you to go as fast as you can. Next article here on Bigler's World, sticking with science news. Astronomers caught a supermassive black hole turning on for the first time. The discovery should help researchers better understand the active cores of galaxies. Adam Mann wrote this particular article. Somewhere in the not-too-distant universe, a cosmic beast is waking up. The monstrous object is a supermassive black hole. Some 300 million light years from Earth, it sits in the center of a galaxy called, and this is very catchy, SDSS 1335 plus 0728. Okay? Hope you wrote that down. Over the past 4 years, astronomers have watched it go from dim and quiet to bright and active. It is the first time such a transition has been observed as it happens. Researchers shared the discovery June 18th in Astronomy and Astrophysics. Pick yours up today. The finding could offer insight into what powers active nuclei of galaxies, which are enormous collections of stars. These active galactic nuclei, or AGN, develop when supermassive black holes gobble up huge amounts of matter. Afterward, they become bright enough to be seen across the cosmos. Rise and shine. Every 2 days, the Zwicky Transient Facility, or the ZTF, scans the entire northern sky. It uses a camera with an extremely wide field of view. Housed at the Palomar Observatory in California, it is run by a public/private partnership. And scientists using the camera there saw this galaxy, with the long number, suddenly and dramatically brighten in December of 2019. Specifically, the galaxy was getting brighter in wavelengths of light that are visible to the human eye. Okay, who is this? Paula Sanchez Sayas, an astrophysicist at the European Southern Observatory in Garching, Germany, says,
at the beginning, we thought, okay, this is a normal AGN candidate.
But then Sanchez Sayas and her colleagues looked at the data for this galaxy going back 20 years. They saw no previous signs of activity. Black holes can light up when they rip apart and consume stars. As material from the stellar feast spins around the black hole, it heats up. This causes the shredded matter to produce bright light. Such events are fairly short-lived, or lived, however you want to put that. They tend to last a few days or months at most. Yet Sanchez Sayas and her colleagues watched SD blah 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 stay bright for the next few years. This hinted that its black hole was going through a more dramatic change. Talk about a glow-up. Then in February, a NASA telescope in low Earth orbit, the Neil Swift Observatory, watched SD blah 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 start glowing in X-rays. Other facilities caught the galaxy giving off even more wavelengths of light.
All the data we have in hand seems to tell us that we are observing the formation of an AGM. And, sorry, for the first time, says Sanchez Sayas,
it's possible that the black hole in SD is eating a smaller galaxy that fell into it. It's eating an entire galaxy. But at this point, it's still unclear exactly what's going on. Observations by NASA's James Webb Space Telescope could reveal more. So could data collected by future facilities, such as the extremely large telescope now being built in Chile. With more data, scientists can watch how gas is moving around in this black hole, and that in turn may help explain why it is turned on, says Sanchez Sayas.
We hope that from this source they will be able to learn how AGNs become AGNs and how supermassive black holes grow.
Okay, let's do one more article here from Science News Explorers. Let's do this thought experiment article here. These imaginary scenarios can reveal real-world misconceptions and gaps in knowledge, says Katie Grace Carpenter, who wrote this. Let's see. Thought experience is a hypothetical scenario addressing a big question. The scenario can sometimes seem absurd, but considering such scenarios can highlight the consequences of a particular idea or theory. One famous thought experiment is known as Schrödinger's cat. Physicist Erwin Schrödinger devised it back in 1933. He did this to illustrate a point about quantum theory. Quantum theory attempts to describe physics at the tiniest scale. One aspect of quantum theory is a concept known as superposition. Superposition says that particles can exist in different states at the same time. Quantum theory also says that when these particles interact, they adopt just one state. But many scientists look at this step further. They said that just observing such a particle caused it to pick a state. Schrödinger found that idea ridiculous, so he came up with a thought experiment. His scenario describes a box with a cat inside. The box connects to a single atom. This atom connects the superposition idea. The atom has a chance of decaying. That means the atom has two potential states, decayed and undecayed. The cat's fate is bound to the atom in this thought experiment. If the atom randomly changes state from undecayed to decayed, then poison kills the imaginary cat. Schrödinger's cat, as it became known. And here's the important part. In this scenario, the cat, the box, and the atom are all unobserved. With no observer, the atom would hypothetically, there it is, be in a state of superposition. It would be both decayed and undecayed at the same time. But the cat's life is linked to this atom's state. So if the atom exists in two states, so does the cat. The cat is both alive and dead, and its state, dead or alive, would only be determined if someone observed the cat or the atom. Okay? That, Schrödinger pointed out, is absurd, but it doesn't mean quantum theory is flawed. In fact, this thought experiment has become a helpful device for understanding the absurd nature of subatomic particles. Thought experiments are not limited to science. No. Other fields such as philosophy, history, and economics use them too. Thought experiments help us reconsider information we already know, but they can also help propose new ways of thinking through and discussing complex questions. Okay, let's go to another publication here. Got an article in Dogo News. Wacky, crazy Dogo News. This article entitled, "These High-Tech Swimsuits Could Give Olympians an Edge at Paris in 2024. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article. In the ultra-competitive world of Olympic swimming, a mere hundredth of a second can make a difference between gold and silver medal. While skills and intense training are essential for success, the right swimsuit can be a game-changer in the tightest of races. For the Paris 2024 Games, Speedo has unveiled the latest iterations, there it is, of its Fastskin LZR Pure Intent and Fastskin LZR Pure Valor swimsuits. The company asserts that since 2019, athletes wearing LZR suits have broken 52% of all individual swimming world records. They also garnered 61% of gold medals at the Tokyo 2020 Games. The recently unveiled LZR Pure Intent 2.0 and Pure Valor 2.0 are engineered with Lemorial Space Tech. The lightweight coating was originally created to protect satellites in space. It makes these swimsuits extremely water-repellent. The LZR Pure Intent 2.0 is designed for sprint swimmers. It features dual compression and textured fabric zones for targeted drag reduction. The LZR Pure Valor 2.0 is made for distance and multi-event swimmers. It offers more moderate compressions and six times the amount of water repellency as previous Valor suits. Caleb Dressler, Ryan Murphy, and Reagan Smith will be among the five elite athletes, swimmers, testing these suits at the Paris Olympics. Who it is this? Kevin Netto, an exercise scientist specialist at the Curtin School of Allied Health in Australia, told AFP, "The biggest factor in swimming, because it's water, is drag, which is far and away the main detractor of speed. So anything that will change drag forces is worth its weight in gold." Speedo is not the only company seeking to give Olympic swimmers a competitive edge. No, no, no. Katie Ledecky, widely regarded as one of the greatest female swimmers of all time, will wear TYR's Venzo suit. It features frictionless yarn that was originally developed for the military in Italy. This ultra-smooth fabric repels water, elevating the body position and reducing resistance. The suit's innovative textile design also provides targeted support for the core and legs, enhancing stability and comfort. The impact of swimsuits on athletic performance is a topic of ongoing debate. However, in sports where fractions of a second can decide races, every tiny advantage matters, says Ryan Murphy. "You're talking about maybe a 1% difference in a race. Any little thing we can get to improve times, improve body position in the water, assist your technique, you're really looking for that." Okay, let's go to another publication. Let's do a little Frontiers for Young Minds. What makes villains evil yet fascinating? Who wrote this here? Peksha Srivastava and Frederick L. Coolidge got together and did this little article here. It's an introduction right here. The White Witch is a perfectly terrible person. She calls herself the Queen of Narnia. Though she has no right to be a queen of all, she can turn people into stone and do all kinds of horrible things. That's from the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Whether it's Darth Vader from Star Wars, the White Witch from Narnia, or Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter, we're captivated and frightened by villains. In this article, we propose that villains may be understood in at least two ways in the discipline of psychology. Foist, according to psychologist Carl Jung, there is a dark and cruel force in everyone's personality called the shadow. Jung proposes that the shadow is hidden or unconscious in most people. Thus, our fascination with villains may come from our ability to relate to them because of our shadow, even though we are also horrified by their behaviors. Second, modern psychologists would see the villains as possibly representing two types of mental illnesses called personality disorders. Again, our interest in villains in stories and movies may come from the fact that these traits may lie hidden in everyone. For example, the desire to break the rules, antisocial, or be excessively self-centered, narcissistic. First off, the shadow. One explanation for our fascination with fear of villains comes from the 20th century psychologist. I thought we already did this. Carl Jung. He described the shadow as a part of everyone's personality. He thought the shadow was a dark and evil force capable of aggression and great cruelty. In most people, thank goodness, the shadow is repressed or hidden. Jung also believed that the shadow could have a positive or creative side. For example, a kind of mother might lash out with great force to defend her children against a wild animal or a threatening person. Or an artist like Pablo Picasso might create a work that completely destroys traditional views of what art should be. Thus, we are entertained by villains. Jung might hypothesize that it's because the shadow is an essential but hidden part of every person. In fact, this is the most likely explanation for young people dressing up in scary costumes at Halloween. They are acting out their shadows. We might even secretly delight in seeing these cruel forces in stories and movies. We could think of villains as having their personalities dominated by the shadow. Yet we rarely enjoy seeing a villain winning at the end. So what might it mean about an individual's personality when they root for the villain to end at the end of a story? Modern psychologists view villains as falling into the category of personality disorders. Personality disorders are long-lasting patterns of feelings and behaviors that often appear in early life and remain stable over time. They can be passed from one generation to the next, but not always. For example, a mean father might or might not produce mean children. Personality disorders cause people great trouble, there it is, in their lives, especially in terms of relating to others. In school, a personality disorder kid may frequently disrupt the classroom by annoying or bullying others and fighting with teachers, among other nuisance behaviors. Personality disorders have a very long history. The Greek philosopher Theophrastus, he described people with personality disorders more than 2,300 years ago, many of which mirrored later modern personality disorders. Two personality disorders are particularly important in explaining the behavior of villains: antisocial and narcissistic, both of which can be said to have elements of Jung's shadow. Jung's view of personality came before modern ideas about personality disorders, and yet his theory provides an additional explanation for these disorders. Antisocial personality disorder. People with antisocial personality disorder have no regard for the feelings of other people. They will say hurtful things or physically hurt others without saying or feeling sorry about it. In fact, it seems they might even delight and take great satisfaction in hurting others. Some of them will even hurt animals and, again, would not feel guilty about it. Thank goodness these antisocial behaviors in children are very rare, and nearly all children respect the feelings of others and would never harm animals or people. As adults, people with antisocial personality disorder may destroy property, ergo someone's house, car, etc., steal from and rob others, and engage in dangerous behaviors without caring for theirs or others' safety. The murderous German dictator Adolf Hitler had an antisocial personality disorder that allowed him to torture and kill millions of people during World War II. Let us relate this information to the descriptions of Lord Voldemort from the Harry Potter series. It's important to note that Voldemort also represents the concept of the shadow, according to Carl Jung. In the story, Voldemort was a descendant of Salazar Slytherin. I guess that's Slytherin, founder of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, was famous for his antisocial behaviors. He hated non-magical people and favored harming them, the Chamber of Secrets. Further, Voldemort's maternal grandfather was cruel, violent towards others, and abused his children. Voldemort's non-magical father was also mean and hated poor people, the half-blood prince. Thus, we can see the essential meanness of the antisocial personality being passed from generation to generation, finally becoming an important characteristic of Voldemort. Known as Tom Riddle in his childhood, Voldemort bullied other children using magic and stole from them when he lived in the orphanage. Headmaster Albus Dumbledore identified instincts for cruelty, secrecy, and domination, even when Tom was 11 years old. I got the parentheses, the half-blood prince. Voldemort stole valuable objects and gained information from adults using manipulation without feeling any guilt. He also broke into his father's and grandfather's houses for revenge. Voldemort cruelly murdered people and divided his soul into pieces, creating Horcruxes. Is that what it is? Horcruxes to attain immortality. He lacked compassion. His violent and aggressive nature is visible in his fights with children and with Dumbledore, Harry, and many others. He killed people when he found them no longer useful. Narcissistic personality disorder. The other personality disorder often seen in villains is narcissistic personality disorder. People with this personality disorder believe that they are superior to everybody around them and enjoy being in charge and dominating others. They love the admiration, attention, and worship of other people. Yet, like people with antisocial personality disorder, they neither care about the feelings of others nor sympathize with other people because they can only think of themselves. Tom Riddle's new name, Lord Voldemort, reflects an essential characteristic of narcissistic personality disorder. He chose Lord, highlighting his excessive self-importance and announcing his strong desire to dominate others. Like his ancestor, Slytherin, he became obsessed with his evil quest for total domination. His maternal grandfather exhibited excessive arrogance and pride because he was Slytherin's descendant. Voldemort's father, although non-magic, was snobbish, rude, and proud to belong to a wealthy, high-class family. These descriptions show how Voldemort would have inherited or been influenced by their narcissistic behaviors. Voldemort believed himself superior and expected others to recognize him as such. He believed that being Slytherin's heir made him unique and gave him the right to deserve special treatment and associate with only high-status people, not as equals, but as servants, who were terrified of him. These are all classic symptoms of a narcissistic personality disorder. He changed his name to Lord Voldemort to cut all ties with his non-magic father, of the same name. His excessive self-centeredness made him think he was superior enough to defeat death. Final thoughts. As we noted earlier, villains may be understood in at least two ways, as the shadow and as having personality disorders such as antisocial and narcissistic. Again, part of our fascination with villains may stem from everyone's potential to commit antisocial acts, yet most people do not. Further, nearly everyone is self-loving to some extent. However, we generally find excessive self-love offensive. In this article, we saw that Lord Voldemort is an excellent example of the dark side of the shadow and that he displayed both antisocial and narcissistic personality disorder behaviors. Now, when you read stories or watch movies, you can explore villains from at least two psychological perspectives and offer interesting explanations when your friends wonder what makes villains so evil yet fascinating. Okay, next article here. Let's stick with CBC Kids News. Bum, 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 bum. What do they got? These two kid sisters. These kid sisters got right to work raising money after Jasper wildfires. Who wrote this? Taylor Katzell. Let's see here. Sisters have fond memories of camping in Jasper. And here's what you need to know. Wildfires in Jasper, Alberta have destroyed roughly one-third of the town and forced about 5,000 residents to evacuate their homes. Residents aren't allowed to return home until officials say it's safe. Two Alberta sisters spent their weekends running a lemonade stand to collect donations for evacuees. Okay, here's the article. When life gives you lemons, raise money for wildfire relief. That's what two sisters did this weekend after finding out that Jasper, Alberta, one of their favorite places to camp, was hit by wildfire. Fires that spread through the town and its famous national park starting last week have forced 25,000 visitors and residents to evacuate and destroyed about a third of the town's structures. The Canadian Red Cross is asking for donations to help the people who were displaced pay for food, accommodations, and other costs. So you got Callie Dyke, 10 years old, and her sister Katie, 9 years old. They got right to work helping raise $360 over the weekend with their lemonade stand in Sylvan Lake in Alberta. And so what's happening in Jasper? As of July 31st, all the fires in the town of Jasper have been extinguished, but the wildfire in the forest surrounding the community continues to burn out of control. That's as of July 31st. Officials have warned that the flames could keep burning for months and remain a danger to Jasper residents for weeks. It is unclear exactly the town's 5,000 residents, how they'll be able to return home. Municipal officials have a list of safety criteria that have to be met first. They warn that as long as the fire keeps burning near the town, residents might have to evacuate again. The Jasper fire might be one of the most destructive wildfires in Canada's history, with preliminary estimates suggesting it has caused more than $700 million worth of damage. Canadian Environmental Minister, Stephen Guilbeault. He said that on Monday that he's been working with government officials to figure out financial assistance for evacuees. As of July 31st, the Red Cross says it will give $750 to every household that had to evacuate, and it's pleading for more donations. Raising money with lemonade, Callie and Katie said they've gone camping. That's in English. Actually, I think that's Canadian. In Jasper, a few times in recent summers, and they say, we love it there, and we have such fun memories of cliff jumping and camping. We found out about the fires. We were heartbroken. And Katie says, we used to love getting beaver tails when we visited there. The past two summers, the sisters have run a lemonade stand to help raise money for Paws and Claws, an animal welfare organization. When they found out about the fires, it was no brainer. This year, they'd raise money for the people of Jasper. Over the weekend, that was the July 27, 28, the sisters sold lemonade, chips, hot dogs, and other snacks, says Callie. It was so nice to see so many of our family members who came out to support us. The sisters said their favorite part was the excitement they felt afterward when they counted the money they had raised. We found out we raised $360, and it felt so joyful because we knew it would make a difference in helping Jasper to regrow, said Callie. Indeed, the Red Cross said any donation, no matter what size, makes an impact. Let's see, who is this? James Hoffing, he's senior manager and media relations for Red Cross. He told CBC Kids News, when people in Canada raise money to help out, it makes a big difference. As is him again, emergency relief may include shelter, food, clothes, blankets, hygiene kits to help people during a difficult time. Until August 24th, the government of Alberta and the government of Canada will donate $1 for every dollar donated to the Red Cross to help those affected by the wildfires. Okay, let's go to another publication altogether. Let's do a little Ducksters Earth Science for Kids. In particular, weather, hurricanes, tropical cyclones. First off, what is a hurricane? A hurricane is a large rotating storm with high speed winds that form over warm waters in tropical areas. Hurricanes have sustained winds of at least 74 miles per hour and an area of low pressure in the center called an eye. Different names for hurricanes. The scientific name for a hurricane is a tropical cyclone. Tropical cyclones go by different names in different places. In North America and the Caribbean, they're called hurricanes. In the Indian Ocean, they are called cyclones. And in Southeast Asia, they are called typhoons. How do hurricanes form? Hurricanes form over warm ocean water of the tropics. When warm, moist air over the water rises, it is replaced by cooler air. The cooler air then will warm and start to rise. This cycle causes huge storm clouds to form. These storm clouds will begin to rotate with the spin of the Earth, forming an organized system. If there's enough warm water, the cycle will continue, and the storm clouds and wind speeds will grow, causing a hurricane to form. Parts of a hurricane. First off, you got your eye. At the center of the hurricane is the eye. It is an area of very low air pressure. There are generally no clouds in the eye and when the wind is calm. So don't let this fool you, however. The most dangerous part of the storm is at the edge of the eye, called the eye wall. The eye wall is, let's see, around the eye, outside of the eye, is a wall made up of very heavy clouds. This is the most dangerous part of a hurricane and where the highest wind speeds are. The winds at the eye wall can reach speeds of 155 miles per hour. Then there's rain bands. All one word, rain bands. Hurricanes have large, spirally bands of rain called rain bands. These bands can drop huge amounts of rainfall, causing flooding when the hurricane hits land. Diameter. Hurricanes can become huge storms. The diameter of the hurricane is measured from one side to the other. Hurricanes can span a diameter of over 600 miles. And then there's the height. The storm clouds that power hurricanes can become very tall. A powerful hurricane can reach 9 miles into the atmosphere. Yikes. So where do tropical cyclones occur? Well, they occur over the ocean in areas near the equator. This is because there is plenty of warm water in these areas to allow the storms to form. And there are seven major areas in the world that tend to produce tropical cyclones. So where do they happen? Hurricanes that form in the Caribbean and the Atlantic Ocean occur between June 1st and November 30th each year. This is called hurricane season. Why are hurricanes dangerous? When hurricanes strike land, they can cause huge amounts of damage. Most of the damage is caused by flooding and storm surge. Storm surge is when the ocean level rises at the coastline due to the power of the storm. The hurricanes can also cause damage with high speeds, high speed winds, that can blow down trees and damage homes. Many hurricanes can develop several small tornadoes as well. So how are they named? Hurricanes in the Atlantic are named based on a list of names maintained by the World Meteorological Organization. The names go in alphabetical order, and the storms are named as they appear. So the first storm of the year will always have a name that starts with the letter A. There are six lists of names each year. A new list is used. And there's the categories. Tropical cyclones are categorized according to the speed of sustained winds. A tropical depression is 38 miles per hour or less. A tropical storm is 39 to 73 miles per hour. As far as hurricanes go, Category 1 is 74 to 95 miles per hour. Category 2 is 96 to 110 miles per hour. Category 3 is 111 to 129 miles per hour. Category 4 is 130 to 156 miles per hour. And Category 5 is 157 miles an hour or higher. Gulp. Interesting facts about hurricanes. Hurricanes rotate counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere and clockwise in the southern hemisphere. This is due to the rotation of the Earth called the Coriolis effect. The letters Q, U, X, Y, and Z are not used for the first letter when naming hurricanes. The names are alternated between boy and girl names. Weather forecasters draw a cone showing where they think the hurricane is most likely to travel. Unless when they got here, you can always find out the latest information on hurricanes and at their website, the National Hurricane Center, which tracks and forecasts hurricanes. Okay, let's do one more earth science section here. In Ducksters, this one's about glaciers. What is a glacier? You're asking yourself all the time, probably. A glacier is a thick mass of ice that covers a large area of land. Around 10% of the world's land is covered by glaciers. Most glaciers are located near the North or South Poles, but they can also exist high in mountain ranges, such as the Himalayas and the Andes. So how do they form? Glaciers form when snow that doesn't melt, even during the summer. Enough snow builds up the weight, the snow will compress and turn into solid ice. It can take hundreds of years for a large glacier to form. Glaciers move. Although glaciers are made of ice and appear to be sitting still, they are actually moving. The weight of a glacier will cause it to move slowly downhill, sort of like a very slow-moving river. The speed of glaciers varies widely, with some moving as slow as a few feet a year, while others may move several feet per day. And you got types of glaciers. Scientists have given names to different types of glaciers. Here are a few of the main types. Calving, as in C-A-L-V-I-N-G. A calving glacier is one that ends in a body of water, like a lake or an ocean. The term calving comes from icebergs that break off the glacier or calve into the water. If the body of water has tides, like an ocean, the glacier may also be called a tidewater glacier. Then there's cirque. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. C-I-R-Q-U-E. Cirque. They are glaciers that form on the slopes of mountains. They are also called alpine or mountain glaciers. Hanging. They got hanging glaciers. They form on the side of a mountain above a glacial valley. They are called hanging because they do not reach the valley where the main glacier is located. And there's an ice cap. An ice cap is formed when the ice completely covers an area of land such that no part of the land, not even mountain peaks, poke through the top of the ice cap. Then there's an ice field. It is when ice completely covers a flat area. Piedmont. A Piedmont glacier is formed when glacier flows into a plain at the edge of a mountain range. Then there's a polar glacier. It's one that is formed in an area where the temperature is always below freezing point. There's temperate. Temperate glacier is one that coexists with liquid water. And a valley glacier is one that fills a valley between two mountains. That's pretty self-explanatory. Glacier features, ablation zone. The ablation zone is the area below the accumulation zone where the glacial ice exists. In this area, there is a loss of ice in mass due to ablation, such as melting and evaporation. And there's the accumulation zone. This is the area of the glacier where snow falls and accumulates. It is located above the ablation zone. It is separated from the ablation zone by the equilibrium line. Oh, I see where this is going. Crevasses. They are giant cracks that occur on the surface of the glacier, typically where the glacier flows the fastest. The fern, F-I-R-N, is a type of compacted snow that lies between the new snow and the glacial ice. Then there's the head. Glacial head is where the glacier starts. That makes sense, too. The terminus is the end of the glacier. It is also called the glacier foot. Glaciers change the land. When glaciers move, they can change the land, creating many interesting geological features. Here are some of the geological features that are created by glaciers. I don't know how to pronounce this. An arete. Anyway, it's spelled A-R-E-T-E. It is a steep ridge formed by two glaciers that erode on opposite sides of the ridge. The cirque, C-I-R-Q-U-E. It is a bowl-shaped landform in the side of a mountain made by the head of the glacier. Then there's the drumlin. It is a long, oval-shaped hill created by glacial ice movement. A fjord is a U-shaped valley between steep cliffs created by glaciers. A horn is a pointy-shaped mountain peak created when many glaciers erode the same mountain top. A moraine is an accumulation of material called till, left behind by the glacier. Examples include rock, sand, gravel, and clay. And a tarn, as in tarnation, T-A-R-N. They are lakes that fill up cirques once the glacier has melted. Here's some interesting facts, fast facts, about glaciers. Most of the country of Greenland is covered with a giant ice cap that is nearly 2 miles thick in areas. Because of friction, the top of glaciers move faster than the bottom. That's crazy stuff. A retreating glacier doesn't actually travel backwards, but is melting faster than it is gaining new ice. Sometimes glaciers will move much faster than normal. This is called a glacial surge. At over 125 miles long, Bering Glacier in Alaska is the longest glacier in the United States. And last one they got here, a scientist who studies glaciers is called a glaciologist. Okay, next article here on Bigler's World. Sticking with ducksters, let's do. We got some history here. A little French Revolution for the kids. What was the French Revolution? It was a period of time in France when the people overthrew the monarchy and took control of the government. When did it take place? Well, it lasted 10 years, from 1789 to 1799. It began on July 14th, 1789, when revolutionaries stormed a prison called the Bastille. The revolution came to an end in 1799 when a general named Napoleon, maybe you've heard of him, overthrew the revolutionary government and established the French consulate, with Napoleon as the leader. The French estates. Before the French Revolution, the people of France were divided into social groups called estates. The first estate included the clergy. Those are church members. The second estate included the nobles. And the third estate included the commoners. Most of the people were members of the third estate. They paid the most of the taxes, while the nobility lived lives of luxury and got all the high-ranking jobs. Revolutionary government. The French government was in constant turmoil throughout the revolution. At the start of the revolution, representatives from the Third Estate established the National Assembly, where they demanded that King Louis, the 16th, he gave them certain rights. This group soon took control of the country. They changed names over time to the Legislative Assembly and later to the National Convention. After the Reign of Terror, a new government was formed called the Directory. The Directory ruled until Napoleon took control. Reign of Terror. The darkest period of the French Revolution is called the Reign of Terror. That lasted from 1793 to 1794. During this time, a man named Robespierre, he led the National Convention and the Committee of Public Safety. He wanted to stamp out any opposition to the revolution, so he called for a rule of terror. Laws were passed that said anyone suspected of treason could be arrested and executed by a guillotine. Thousands of people were executed, including Queen Marie Antoinette and many of Robespierre's political rivals. Political clubs. Many of the new political ideas and alliances of the French Revolution were formed in political clubs. These clubs included the powerful Jacobin Club, led by Robespierre, and the Cordeliers, the Fruliants Club, and the Pantheon Club. And the outcome? Well, the French Revolution completely changed the social and political structure of France. It put an end to the French monarchy, feudalism, and took political power from the Catholic Church. It brought new ideas to Europe, including liberty and freedom for the commoner, as well as the abolishment of slavery and the rights for women. Although the revolution ended with the rise of Napoleon, the ideas and reforms did not die. These new ideas continued to influence Europe and helped to shape many of Europe's modern-day governments. Okay, next article here. Sticking with that whole French theme. Colonial America, French and Indian War. The French and Indian War was a major war fought in the American colonies between 1754 and 1763. The British gained significant territory in North America as a result of the war. So who fought in the French and Indian War? I'm trying to think. From the name of the war, you'd probably guess that the French fought the Indians during the French and Indian War, but actually, the main enemies in the war were the French and the British. Both sides had American Indian allies. The French allied with several tribes, including the Shawnee, Lenape, Ojibwa, Ottawa, and the Algonquin peoples. The British allied, there it is, with the Iroquois, the Catawba, and the Cherokee, at least for a time. How is it different from the Seven Years' War, you're always asking yourself? The French and Indian War is considered part of the Seven Years' War. It was fought throughout much of the world. The portion of the Seven Years' War that was fought in North America is called the French and Indian War. Okay, you got that? Where was it fought? Well, it was fought mostly in the Northeast, along the border between the British colonies and the French colonies of New France. Leading up to war, as the American colonies began to expand to the West, they came into conflict with the French. The first real conflict began when the French moved into the Ohio country and built Fort Desquinissy, on the Ohio River, where the city of Pittsburgh is today. It was over the construction of this fort that the first battle of the war, the Battle of Jumonville Glen, took place May 28, 1754. We got some major battles and events here. General Braddock at Fort Duquesne, that was in 1755. British General Braddock led 1,500 men to take the fort. They were ambushed and soundly defeated by the French and Indian soldiers. Battle of Fort Oswego from, 1756. The French captured the British Fort Oswego and took 1,700 prisoners captive. About the massacre at Fort William Henry, 1757, the French took Fort William Henry. Many British soldiers were massacred as France's Indian allies violated the terms of the British surrender and killed around 150 British soldiers. The Battle of Quebec, 1759, the British claimed a decisive victory over the French and occupied Quebec City. Fall of Montreal, that's 1760. The city of Montreal falls to the British, led by Field Marshal Jeffrey Amherst. The fighting is nearly over in the American colonies. So then the end of the war and its results. The French and Indian War ended February 10th, 1763, with the signing of the Treaty of Paris. France was forced to give up all of its North American territory. Britain gained all the land east of the Mississippi River, and Spain gained the land west of the Mississippi. Consequences? Well, the French and Indian War had some major consequences on the future of the British colonies in America. The war was expensive for British government to fight. In order to pay for it, they issued taxes on the colonies. The British government considered this fair, as they were protecting the interests of the colonies. The colonies, however, felt that they should not be taxed unless they had representation in the British government. Also, this war was the first time that the colonies united together to fight a common enemy. They built up colonial militias and gained confidence in their fighting abilities. In the end, the events of the French and Indian War played a major role leading up to the American Revolution. And here are some interesting facts about the French and Indian War. Daniel Boone, or as we call him, Dan'l Boone, was a supply wagon driver during the French and Indian War. George Washington served as a colonel in the provincial militia during the war. He was the leader at the first battle of the war, the Battle of Jumonville Glen. The British captured Havana, Cuba, from Spain in 1762, near the end of the war. They later exchanged Havana for Florida as part of the peace treaty. The French were greatly outnumbered by the British and had to rely heavily on American Indian soldiers and allies. And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.